Chief Justice Steele, and may it please the Court, my name is Bernard O'Donnell. I'm here on behalf of Alejandro Cruz, who was convicted of murder first degree and related offenses in the Superior Court. At trial, says Mr. Cruz, raised three defenses, that the homicide did not constitute murder first degree, but a lesser offense, that he employed self-defense properly, and that he suffered from extreme emotional distress as a mitigator to punishment for murder first degree. This morning I'd like to address essentially and emphasize one of those claims, and that is the claim that the conviction for murder first degree was against the weight of the evidence. We're not going to address the question of whether there was sufficient evidence of intentional, says murder, because based upon an appraisal of the evidence, it looks like there was, because based upon the entire record, the homicide, the wounds causing death, occurred after Mr. Cruz had control of the situation. So the issue that we're going to emphasize this morning is that based upon, says the entire record, the uncontroverted evidence indicated that there was sufficient evidence to mitigate, says the punishment, and to sentence Mr. Cruz for manslaughter as a result of his extreme emotional distress.
I'm interested in your use of the adjective uncontroverted evidence.
Yes.
What is your contention that is absent that needed to be there in order to reach a conclusion that it was controverted, not uncontroverted?
Well, there, it was uncontroverted that, of course, Mr. Cruz was living in an alien's environment, which causes stress. There were a number of stress factors shown, says, at this trial, numerous stress factors shown at this trial, which were not really controverted by the state at all. His dangerous experiences as a law enforcement officer in Mexico, it's a significant stress factor, besides the fact of being an alien, as in this country, in a foreign country, that he genuinely missed his family and children in Mexico, and the particular circumstances prior to this homicide, that he hadn't seen them for months, that he looked forward to being able to celebrate with them the First Communion and confirmation of two of his children, which is a significant, says, event, because for Mexicans as Catholic. These are uncontroverted facts.
Aren't they all dependent upon the credibility of Mr. Cruz?
To an extent, says yes. That is true. But in that respect, I'd like to bring up, says, a hypothetical that I've thought of before in the context of some prior cases, but it's sort of the hypothetical that I'd ask the court to consider that question in this context, that, you know, credibility, there's too much burden that can be placed on, says, the mules of credibility. And I ask the court to consider this example. What if there's a homicide anywhere? Says, let's say, it says in Dover here, and that Mrs. Blackstone, says, is murdered. She's knifed to death, says, in her home. And the corpus delicti of a homicide is established beyond any doubt. And let's say the later defendant, is arrested for an unrelated, says, offense. Let's say even he's walking down the highway not wearing a light or flashlight or beacon, whatever it is, and he's taken into custody. And he happens to live a few blocks away, says, from the scene of the homicide. And under those circumstances, he's interrogated during his processing and asked whether, you know, he committed this homicide. And he's confronted with the facts of the homicide of Mrs. Blackstone, who lives several blocks away. And he vigorously denies any connections to the offense. But he's nonetheless charged with it. He goes to trial. And the prosecution argues, as the state believed, and possibly the jury could argue that this meant he perspires as well being questioned. He didn't have an alibi. He couldn't do this. He couldn't do that. Can the finder of fact disregard his claims of non-culpability and find him guilty of the offense because he wasn't credible in denying the offense, and it evidenced a guilty mind? And the evidence of his guilty mind, along with the commission of the homicide itself, was sufficient to establish his guilt. You know, I haven't seen that examples as yet, but, you know, this scenario here shares some similarities with that hypothetical.
Well, in this case, it was a bench trial. Do you agree if it had been a jury trial, the jury could have come back with the same verdict that the trial judge came back with no explanation?
Yes.
And consequently, are you asking us to make some pronouncement that if you're the trier of fact at a bench trial, it's incumbent upon you to say something that a jury would not have to say in the same circumstance?
That issue is something that I struggled with when looking at this case, and perhaps I gather the court has some concerns about it, as reflected by Your Honor's question. There should be a greater, says, burden on the trial court, says, under these. There is a greater burden. For instance, under Rule 33, if either party, says, requests the trial court to make fact findings and apply legal standards to its findings of guilt or acquittal, the trial court is required to do so. The court shall. Now, I don't know why the trial court isn't required to do that under, says, all circumstances, particularly circumstances where it could be a close call.
Well, yeah. In this case, you agree our standard of review is plain error.
Yes, sir.
So we have a situation where no one asked the court to do anything other than what the court did, and you want us to say, under the plain error standard of review, the judge should have known he had to do more.
Correct, under the facts of this case, because it's a close call. I can't put my hands on the issue of the arm, because I did see it's not controlling in this case, but I found a Third Circuit decision from back in, I think it was 1972 or thereabouts, United States versus Livingston, where the court reflected that findings of fact are essential to proper appellate review of a conviction resulting from a non-jury trial. But yet we have a rule, and it's not merely the Superior Court's rule, but it's also the federal rule that doesn't, 33, that doesn't require fact findings by the bench trial court.
Mr. O'Donnell, maybe I oversimplified this case in my mind, but I thought your argument was that in the face of expert testimony that the defendant suffered from EED at the time of the homicide, that he was entitled to have the charge reduced to manslaughter. It's uncontroverted, I understood the argument to be, because the state offered no evidence to contradict the evidence that was produced by the defense in any rebuttal case. And I thought the argument was going to where the defense offers an expert who establishes EED based upon objective facts about the individual's history, then in the absence of someone contradicting that, the court had no choice but to find that it must reduce the charge to manslaughter. That's what I thought the argument was. Apparently it's more complex than I thought. And it caused me to think in my mind about an analogy to our law in personal injury cases, which I don't ask my colleagues to necessarily agree with my statement of it, but this is my understanding of it. If in an automobile personal injury case, a plaintiff offers an expert witness who, based on objective evidence, such as a radiologist report, MRI, X-ray, whatever the basis may be, suggests that the injuries were proximately caused by the accident, and the jury comes back in the absence of any contradictory medical testimony from the defense, and the jury comes back with zero damages for the plaintiff, there either has to be an additure or a new trial. On the other hand, if the plaintiff offers expert testimony and that expert testimony is based solely on subjective evidence, namely only what the plaintiff tells them, and the jury comes back in the face of clear liability with a zero verdict, when that medical testimony is uncontradicted, the plaintiff is not entitled to a new trial or an additure because the jury could disregard the credibility of that subjective testimony, which was the sole basis for the medical expert. Is there any analogy that could be drawn, if I accurately state our civil law, is there any analogy that could be drawn to this situation? And even if there could, should we draw that analogy or even consider drawing it?
I had not considered that analogy. I apologize. I don't have Your Honor's breadth of experience, as with all these cases. However, I believe the analogy is applicable. I did think of that, as in this case, and
Let's just hypothetically assume that the analogy is applicable here. Then my question becomes, is this evidence on which the expert based his opinion of I served in a paramilitary organization in Mexico, I saw many horrible things as a result, I'm an alien in an alien land, although one can make the argument there is no American culture anymore, it's so mixed and varied, nothing's alien to anyone anymore in this country. I wanted to be back with my children before their first communion. That was very important to me. I was under a lot of stress financially because I didn't get my income tax return on time. Is that subjective testimony or is that objective testimony for the basis of the expert's opinion?
I don't believe it's subjective testimony. I believe it's objective testimony. And I don't mean to sound like a weasel about it, but it's objective testimony because it's not rebutted to some extent.
You wouldn't be the first to weasel over similar testimony, so don't worry about it.
So I wasn't prepared to argue that because the state had the state did not present its own expert witness to conclude the opposite of what Dr. Pereira concluded, that therefore it was mandated that the verdict must be for extreme emotional distress and manslaughter. But my argument was that, along with all of the other uncontroverted, and it says objective eyewitness or personal testimony, says in this case, was sufficient to establish the defense of extreme emotional distress by a preponderance of the evidence.
Well, that essentially is my argument. The state's position in this case is twofold. The first position is that they didn't have to put on a case because they effectively cross-examined the expert. And then their second position is, based on their effective cross-examination, it really changed the case into the subjective type of analysis, and it was up for the trier of fact in a bench trial to weigh the credibility of the witnesses.
Well, perhaps I misunderstood the question, but I think that somewhat similar to, I'd like to reiterate what we're maintaining says here, that in the that the trial court simply can't disregard just a wealth of evidence because the trial court chooses to do so, and therefore because the trial court disregard has the liberty ordinarily just to weigh evidence is the same as the trial court need not consider as evidence.
Well, let me put it a slightly different way. Couldn't the trier of fact, in this case the judge, have considered all of the evidence in terms of your client's background and his concerns and his children and all of those things and listen to the expert who said, I'm putting all these things together and saying this equals extreme emotional distress. And the trial judge says, I'm listening to all those things. And, yeah, that means that this defendant was not in a good frame of mind, for sure, but I don't think it's enough to constitute extreme emotional defense. Isn't the trial judge entitled to make that differentiation of degree and say this wasn't enough to prove, or even by a preponderance of the evidence, to establish an EED?
I agree. But one of the fundamental problems I'm having with grasping that result is that there were no fact findings here, albeit none were requested.
I think the problem that we're wrestling with is that there's no standard that's been presented to us to determine, or for a judge, sitting as a fact finder, to determine whether it's a matter of law the judge had to accept the testimony of the defense side, or had the discretion to disregard it. I mean, there has to be some mechanic, some principle that's easily applicable, such as the analogy that the Chief Justice suggested. But we don't really have anything. Well, all we have are a bunch of facts that are thrown up in the air, so to speak, and we're being told, that those facts are not sufficient.
I think the best I can say in response to that is that the trial judge can't disregard all of the evidence that is contrary to.
Well, we don't know that he disregarded all of the evidence.
That's a problem.
We don't know that. So I don't know how we could proceed from that premise. I think the record lends itself equally to the interpretation that the judge did consider all the evidence. He considered all of the statements of subjective belief and subjective fear the defendant made. In order to support a claim of extreme emotional distress. But at the same time, he said, well, I understand, what the defendant says, but look what he did, and then considered the very deliberate way in which, after the stabbing, this defendant meticulously disposed of the evidence.
Unfortunately, we don't know, but from the defendant's testimony, looking closely at his testimony, what this was—it was uncontroverted that he exercised self-defense. I mean, the victim came at him again, and then he snapped out, and he was in a rage, a frenzy of mind. 68 stab wounds.
Well, help us rule in your favor, and by telling us, under the plain error standard of review, this court has to say, notwithstanding the fact that no one asked the trial judge to do anything other than the trial judge did, it was plain error and adverse to the interest of justice for the trial judge to conduct this bench trial, just as all other bench trials have been conducted prior to here, because what are we going to cite in support of that holding? What's the best authority you have for us to cite?
It wasn't. Again, there's a case that I haven't located. It's called Milton. It's in the Tenth Circuit, 1970. These are all very old cases, but the failure to request findings.
They're not old to all of us.
Okay, I apologize. It's not that old to me anymore. Failure to request findings does not foreclose plain error review. That's not the general precept, although that's not the controlling precept, but
okay,
it's a possibility.
Well, I accept that as an accurate proposition, but we still come back to what authority are we going to cite under this plain error standard of review for the proposition that this should have been clear to the trial judge?
I understand, as Your Honor's concern. My contention would be that under the facts of this particular case, where there was substantial, uncontroverted evidence supporting a mitigation of extreme emotional distress, it was plain error either not to find that or to not express a basis for finding against it. Now, I'm not here to quarrel with the trial judge or make the trial judge look bad. I want to make that perfectly clear. The defense didn't request findings. The state didn't request findings. They were on the winning side, but what if the judge had acquitted? Or granted, the state would be in the same position I am now if it had not requested findings.
Now, isn't the nub of your position that where there's substantial evidence of a defense or a mitigator, however you want to characterize it, the judge in a bench trial has to at least write an opinion?
I'd agree with that.
Because no matter which way the judge came out, somebody would have cause to make your argument. Same argument you're making.
Yes, sir. And as I said, I'm not trying to be hypercritical, says of the trial judge. The core of what we're looking at, it was, in fact, in fairness to the trial judge and to the state, at the sentencing, the trial judge, you know, addressed this tangentially. During sentencing, the trial judge observed, at the end of the day in this instance, Mr. Cruz, this was sua sponte, at the end of the day in this instance, Mr. Cruz made a decision to kill. The court has found that there was an intentional decision fueled by, perhaps by anger and frustration, but not emotions that led the court to believe that would rise to a level of emotional distress, much less extreme emotional distress. There was a moment in time, even assuming that the encounter occurred, as Mr. Cruz explained, where Mr. Cruz had an opportunity to disengage and did not. If he had chosen to disengage from the encounter, we would not be here talking about a murder case. We'd be here talking about something very different from that. This is unfortunate as well. Now, I'm just trying to be fair. I'm not trying to hide anything. The trial judge said what there should have been a much greater elaboration of that under the facts of this case.
Did you want to save the balance of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice. Justices, good morning. Paul Wallace on behalf of the state. The rule that Mr. Cruz really wants is this. If I kill my victim, if I'm the only other person to say what happened, and I say that in my own sworn testimony, and I have an expert to back me up, then the state must bring on their own expert to try to counter that. That is counterintuitive to every rule that this court follows when it comes to criminal cases. Specifically, this court has said time and time again that the finding of sanity or mental state or extreme emotional distress is a finding of fact in and of itself.
Does the defense actually make that specific argument in their brief? I thought the argument was that, you know, where all of these conditions have occurred, the trial judge sitting as a finder of fact must at least write an opinion analyzing the facts to support whatever the conclusion would be.
Your Honor, I apologize.
Whether there's expert testimony adduced by the state or not.
I apologize, Your Honor, but I differ in their argument in their brief and their argument made here. In their brief, they say nothing about the fact that the judge erred by not making specific findings of fact, and that's a necessary tool in these cases.
Right, but do they argue that the state was, in order to sustain the verdict here, was obligated to put on its own expert?
Well, several times they say it's uncontroverted. The facts cried out. Because we brought an expert and he said this guy acted under extreme emotional distress.
Are you just inferring the argument that you're attributing to them, or do they actually say it? And can you point to a page in the brief? Because I don't recall seeing the argument made in that form.
I'd suggest that the first paragraph says it, perhaps not in so many words. And I'd also suggest that if you look at I believe it's around page 9 and 10 when they're talking about what the facts showed here and the facts did not. Time and again, they say uncontroverted. The rule, it seems, that they would like is this, that the judge must give full credibility to the defendant's statement and their expert, and if the judge doesn't, the judge errors, and if the state doesn't call an expert, then must find extreme emotional distress.
Okay, well, if we're going to use the word uncontroverted as the springboard, then I guess the question becomes, what are we talking about when we say uncontroverted? Are we talking about the basic facts that underlie, that is, the behavior of this defendant, what he actually did, or are we talking about what inferences, expert inferences, can be drawn from that behavior as to what was going on in his head?
From the reading of their brief, it's both. They're saying, look, our defendant said, Cruz said, this happened, that happened, that she attacked him first. He said it was uncontroverted that there was self-defense. Well, unfortunately, there were only two people there, and one is dead. So there's no way to controvert whether or not she went after him first. And then tries to add upon that expert testimony, which comes from where? Well, his mouth. The expert must rely wholly on what Mr. Cruz told him happened and what was going on in his head. The state suggests respectfully that this is a much simpler case than that. This court has said time and time again that those findings are findings of fact. Whether or not it is a better rule in a bench trial to have a judge do an opinion which sets forth the facts or not, honestly, the state wouldn't be in the same place. If we got an acquittal, I couldn't be here.
Well, you don't take the position, do you, that when there's a bench trial, all the judge needs to do is leave the room, come back in, and after announcing he has a verdict, then have the prothonotary ask him, and what is your verdict, guilty or not guilty, and he need only say guilty?
I believe Rule 23C says precisely that, Your Honor, that the court shall make a general finding of either guilt or innocence, and on request shall make specific findings of fact before that general finding. Most often in my experience, bench trials, judges do make some factual findings before he or she will render their verdict, but it's not required. All that is required is to say guilt or not guilty.
The question is what must the record look like in order to be adequate for appellate review? In a jury trial, we at least have the jury instructions as the framework for setting out the issues, the fact issues that the jury needs to resolve. And you can, at least in many cases, reverse engineer. That is, you can take the general verdict and then figure out from the instructions, what the rationale was. Not in every case, but at least there's something there to review. In a case where the judge is the trier of fact and comes back and says guilty or not guilty with no explanation, you have zero to review. The judge isn't going to instruct himself.
But I'd suggest, Your Honor, there's the assumption that the judge knows the law. The judge knows what the relative standards of
proof
are.
Yes, but we're not mind readers, and if we're asked to review that decision, how do we ascertain what the reasoning process that got the judge to the bottom line?
I'd suggest respectfully that we must start with the presumption that trial judge sitting in a criminal case is aware of the applicable law in that case. And so, for instance, in this case, the judge was aware that the state, if we're looking at an extreme emotional distress claim, must first prove the intentional killing. My understanding now is that there's no question as to that any longer, and then shifts to the second part, and that is looking at the defense evidence to determine whether or not they have proved by preponderance of the evidence the two facts that must be proved. First of all, that he acted under extreme emotional distress, and secondly, that there's a reasonable basis for that extreme emotional distress. That's what 641 says. It says, first, this is a fact finding. The very first wording in 641, the fact that an accused intentionally caused the death. And so I think we can presume that a trial judge sitting in superior court on a murder case with an extreme emotional distress does give him or herself
the basis. Well, how does that work in a jury trial if the defense had been presented? Would the judge have then commented and said to the prosecution, you need to put on a case? Or how does that really play out? In this particular case, from the bench, the judge could have said, okay, I've concluded this is an intentional killing, but I'm impressed by the defense expert, and now I want the state to present its case in rebuttal. Or does it just kind of evolve, and the state decides on its own whether it's going to present evidence without an announcement from the bench in a jury trial, staying with that, that the prosecution better come forward?
It is the latter, Your Honor. It's up to the prosecutor is to make a strategic choice. And, in fact, that's exactly what happened in this case. Prosecution made a strategic choice. And when you're talking about mental illness defenses, it's a difficult decision for a prosecutor to make because, in this case, there was the decision obviously made that Dr. Ferrara's testimony was so incredible as to extreme emotional distress and that he did not prove, first of all, it wasn't sufficient to even raise to a preponderance of the evidence that he was acting under extreme emotional distress or, more likely, the second prong, that there was a rational basis for it, reasonable basis for it.
Let's go back to Justice Jacob's question about the jury instructions. Would the jury be instructed, you've heard this defense of extreme emotional defense, words to the effect somewhere in the instructions, the state has to prove it's an intentional killing, and then if the defense comes forward and you're satisfied with the defense, and then the state has to do something else. Is that all laid out for the jury?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. And by my experience, that's precisely what happens. The instruction would tell you must first find that the state has proven that Alejandro Cruz caused the death intentionally. Only then do you consider whether or not there is an extreme, there is a defense of extreme emotional distress. You must find these two things by a preponderance of the evidence. First, that he acted under extreme emotional distress. And secondly, that there is a reasonable explanation or excuse for his claim of extreme emotional distress.
Let's hypothesize a better set of facts for the defendant here. And let's assume that instead of stabbing the woman 68 times and then disposing of the body, what happened, at least in terms of what comes out at trial without anybody contradicting it, is that this person grabbed his child and was running away with the child and said, you're never going to see your child again, and in a desperate move and in an emotional turmoil, the person stabs and kills the victim. So what I'm trying to posit is a situation that would come a lot closer, let's say, to extreme emotional distress that is reasonable under the circumstances. And if that were what's presented, and either the judge or a jury said, well, we're not going to find extreme emotional distress here. We're going to go with the full first-degree murder. Would there be any basis to overturn that?
Well, Your Honor, I think that it comes to the normal standards of review that this court has, and that is whether or not the finding was clearly wrong, that the fact that the person was not acting under extreme emotional distress or there was no reasonable basis. But as this court has said time and time again, in findings of fact by the trial court, either by the jury or by the judge, it's a very high standard. And in fact,
so is it the no rational juror kind of thing?
I'd suggest that it's the clearly wrong, and the court is convinced a mistake has been made, which justice must be injustice must be corrected. I think it's that standard, because it is a finding of fact made by the trial court.
So, in other words, this court can review the evidence that was presented and make its own determination as to whether it was clearly wrong for the court not to find EED.
Yes, but I'd suggest there are a couple hurdles to it that the court has laid out in its own cases, and that is, first of all, substantial evidence exists for the finding of fact. The court must accept that ruling as it must and not make its own factual conclusions, weigh evidence, or make credibility determinations. I believe all of that standard comes along with this court's review of the fact, or in this case, non-fact, that extreme emotional distress did not.
All of that law presupposes that what we are reviewing are findings of fact that have been made by a trial judge, not a record in the absence of any statement from the trial judge about why he or she found some facts significant, others insignificant, and a principled process for weighing the facts and reaching the ultimate conclusion. In the absence of that, either orally on the record or in a written opinion, How can we do anything other than review the case on its facts de novo?
Your Honor, I believe it goes directly to, as Justice Berger just mentioned, it ends up being in terms the could any rational finder of fact not find this, because you'd be in the same situation with a jury.
Okay, back to the facts of this case. EED is established by the defense by a preponderance of the evidence, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
In the absence of any facts to the contrary than those established by the defendant in making his case for preponderance of the evidence, and in the absence of any facts contradicting expert testimony, presumably to a professional standard and to some kind of objective analysis, how does a trial judge differ with those facts? And how do we know that he or she has, and why, in the absence of some explanation?
Well, Your Honor, I'd suggest that what the court determines, or what the court would look to, is the fact that the trial judge or the jury, because both of them engage in exactly the same exercise when trying to determine this fact, makes credibility determinations about the defendant's testimony, for instance, in this case, or the expert's testimony in this case. And this court said time and again.
But when the judge doesn't do that, other than come back with a guilty and a rejection of the EED by implication, how do we know that process has been followed?
I'd suggest respectfully, Your Honor, that you know just as well as when a jury does, because the jury does precisely the same thing.
The difference there is the defense asked for a jury trial and knows what he or she's going to get when they do. When they ask for a bench trial, don't they anticipate they're going to get a reasoned decision that's documented by the facts and an analytical process subject to review by an appellate court?
No, I don't. I suggest, Your Honor, there's no more belief that they are going to get greater findings of fact than they might out of a jury, unless they exercise the option under Rule 23C.
Well,
they can do that. So can the state. They chose not to in this case.
I understand, Your Honor.
You know, in a jury trial, the jury's general verdict is bounded by the instructions. Yeah, of course, in a judge trial, the judge's determination is bound by the law. But the difference is that in a jury trial, the bounding instructions, you know, that set up the factual issues for the jury to determine are on the record. And therefore, there is something in writing that this court could review. Not so when the trial judge simply comes back with a guilty or not guilty.
Your Honor, I'm going to be honest that I have not done a great deal of research on what exactly the trial judge must do as far as the finding of facts and how they must set the record, quite honestly, because that's not really what was briefed by the defense in this case.
No, but you understand our concern is, regardless of what the trial judge must or must not do or on application of the parties or not, our struggle is we're being asked to review it on appeal, and we have to have some rational basis for review, and we have to have some idea of why the trial judge reached the conclusion that the trial judge did.
I suggest respectfully, Your Honor, that, and I cannot tell you that I know a case site on this or whether or not what I am going to say is absolutely true, but it seems to me intuitively that there is a presumption that a trial judge sitting in a case knows the instructions that he or she would have given a jury and is using those same instructions him or herself when they're making the decisions.
I accept that, but let's just take this case by way of example. Let's assume we know that the trial judge knows that preponderance of the evidence is required, knows what the defense of EED really means, understands what beyond a reasonable doubt means, all the rest of that. The review here is, why did the trial judge find the evidence about EED so insignificant in light of the fact the only thing that contradicted it was the prosecutor's cross-examination? What was it about the judge's thought process that concluded, A, all these background facts and history given by the defendant, similar to a clinical history given to a doctor, were entirely subjective, undocumented, and therefore subject to testing the defendant's credibility? To what extent did the trial judge listen to the expert when the expert said, not just their credentials, but that within reasonable standards common in my profession, I accept these, as all my other fellow practitioners would, to be facts upon which I can base an opinion. And with to a reasonable certainty in my professional standards, these facts establish, in my profession's mind, extreme emotional distress. Now, why did the trial judge, if all that happened, why did the trial judge reject it? What was the rational basis for discounting it entirely and instead saying, I think this clearly was an intentional murder and I don't believe that EED applies here? That's basically all we know.
I believe if the trial judge had simply said, I've considered both the defendant and the defense expert's testimony and I don't find them to be credible, that would have been simply enough. And I suggest respectfully that when you look, this is such a fact-driven situation here because you've
you
got the facts of the matter.
You have on review to know why the trial judge didn't find it credible? He can just do an ipsy-dixit and say, I don't find it credible?
I suggest that if a jury can, then yes, Your Honor, the trial judge can also. Because that's, and if the defense wants something more, they have the mechanism to do it.
I understand your point on that.
I suggest that in this case, what we're talking about is whether or not, that two things, whether the extreme emotional distress, first of all, was present. And as a matter of science, there is no psychologist who can get up and say, I find to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty that it existed, because there is no such thing in science. It is only in law. In fact, that's part of the cross-examination of Dr. Farrar was, this is a legal matter, isn't it? This isn't that you can't go to the DSM-IV and say, boom, 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 here it is.
Well, does that mean we're getting the morass that insanity is not a scientific or medical concept but only a legal one? I mean, is this similar to that?
Somewhat. But I never
have a doctor testify somebody was, quote, insane, close quote.
But we do have them. We do have them testify as to whether or not, based on whatever the mental health findings are that they have, they in fact have certain diagnoses, and those would have impeded them from knowingly being able to curtail their behavior. Extreme emotional distress is a much different animal, quite honestly, than insanity, because what it is an attempt to say, I acted intentionally, but certain things were going on with me that are all fact-driven that excuses that. So I suggest that a trial judge or a jury sitting there can say, I've heard what he said. I've heard his explanation as to what the defendant told him, and I've heard what the defendant said. And I've decided it simply isn't credible, either as to one or the other, either that extreme emotional distress didn't actually exist or that it wasn't a reasonable basis for it, because he has to prove both. And I suggest probably, more likely, it was the second in this case that was the issue.
Let me put another hypothetical to you. What if there's a particular judge who feels that extreme emotional distress is just a boondoggle? It really doesn't have any qualitative value to it, and sure, a defendant can try to use that, but I don't buy it. If that were the attitude of the judge, and all kinds of evidence was presented of extreme emotional distress, that judge presumably would say, no, I'm not finding extreme emotional distress. Is the defense or the mitigator so open-ended that somebody who's just not inclined to ever find this mitigator is free to do so?
I suggest, and I think this, I'm unfortunately going to go back to the same answer I gave Your Honor before, and that is that because it is a finding of fact, and that there are certain standards of review that the court has as to whether or not it was clearly wrong. Again, if you got more into the situation that Your Honor had discussed before, of the parent and running away with a child, that you may get to that. If a judge truly believes that, the judge shouldn't be sitting on the case and should recuse him or herself. But you may end up with the same problem with 12 people sitting there thinking, all this psychobabble doesn't mean anything to me. That's kind of the
you agree that comes. if the defendant had requested special findings and the judge said, No, I don't have time for that.
We'd be going back.
I
know how those rules work, Your Honor. I believe the judge would have erred there, because the rule says clearly, upon request, shall make those findings.
I'm fascinated by your psychobabble comment. If this truly was believed to be...
I knew that one was going to get me in trouble, sorry.
If this were truly believed to be psychobabble, wouldn't the prosecutor have filed a Daubert motion to exclude it, and the judge could then have made a ruling on whether it was babble or whether it was scientific knowledge that would be helpful in reaching the right result?
Your Honor, my experience is this. Certain mental health experts are far more willing to go out on a limb than others, and in this case, I believe that Dr. Farrar did.
That applies to many experts.
As a prosecutor, when you are sitting there strategically trying to decide what to do with that case, if this had been a jury trial, and then we brought in a very credible mental health expert to try to counter Dr. Farrar, there are two problems with that strategically as a prosecutor. You start to give some credence to this person that you believe isn't giving credible testimony. Look, oh, they had to get their own, you get this battle of experts, instead of trying to do what the prosecutor did here, and the judge found, beyond a reasonable doubt, that, in fact, this wasn't a credible claim of extreme emotional distress. It was based only on the defendant's version of what happened, and then an expert who came in to say, yeah, that's extreme emotional distress to me. I suggest that if we, and I guess I'm ending where I began, some attempt to forge a rule that would say the state better come up with evidence whenever they bring on an expert or a defendant says he was acting extreme emotional distress, otherwise the findings of fact are some way deficient, would be very troublesome, because we're going to extend trials unnecessarily when instead a prosecutor can do exactly what happened here, cross-examine the expert, show that it's not credible, and have a valid finding of fact by the judge that, in fact, he was guilty of first-degree murder. I see my...
Thank you very much.
Time is up.
A thought occurred to me in listening to the court's questions and Mr. Wallace's answers in the discussion of the case. A thought occurred to me, and I thought by raising it, I haven't left the solar system of law or this case. But the thought that occurred to me is, and I pose it as a rhetorical question, are general verdicts, and this is an ideal panel to ask the question of, because are general verdicts permitted in the Court of Chancery? And if they are, would it present a problem, says on appeal? Frankly, I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, let me suggest to you, thankfully, Justice Holland reached behind the bench and brought out the rules. And Rule 23 says, as interpreted by Scott versus State as long ago as 1955, and even I will concede that's an old case, that if specific findings are not requested, the court may render a general verdict without any findings. If this course is followed, all pertinent questions of fact, if there's sufficient evidence to support them, will be resolved in favor of the findings of the lower court. Now, is this case any more complicated than a holding that no specific findings of fact were requested? We have nothing to review but the facts in the record?
We're contending that there
we have no basis to differ with the trial judge if the record supports what is implicitly his finding of fact.
We're contending that there were sufficient, more than sufficient facts to establish the mitigator of extreme emotional distress, and no sufficient facts to contradict it, particularly in view of the lack of findings as by the trial court. I'd like to, in rebuttal, says rebut. The state's contention that what the defense is really arguing here is that if the defendant testifies and he has an expert, an opinion, then the state must rebut it specifically. You know, we're not arguing that here. We're not arguing that at all. And I thought of a case that came up as recently as Muneer George, another homicide case, and I believe an EE defense was presented in that case. I forget who the if there were experts or whatever, but this was the homicide of Christiana Hilton, the doctor, the veterinarian who killed a fellow congregant in his church, shot him in front of a lot of people. Those are different facts than this case. Under those facts, there were 10 or more witnesses at trial who witnessed the offense, who knew the defendant intimately or very well. And all those people says testified. Those facts are different in the sense the facts could contradict the defense based on that record. But had there been no specific factual findings in a bench trial, this case is different, we contend. And really, there are only two people there? Well, yes, there are only two people there. Sometimes there are only two people. Yes, sometimes that happens. And sometimes that results in the lack of evidence that you'd rather have, whether you're the prosecutor or the defense. But those are the facts that you're left with when considering this as the case on appeal. Your Honor, says Chief Justice Steele, you raised a question about doesn't the defense anticipate fact findings in a bench trial? Well, probably says they do based upon experience. And in this particular case, I had a discussion with the defense counsel as to why she didn't ask. But let me suggest one thing. There wasn't a voluntary and knowing relinquishment of the right here. Under these circumstances, the trial court could have asked. I think given the dialogue there, the way the trial court asked it, I'll announce a general verdict. The trial court was sort of inviting subtly, well, what's your position on it? And there was just silence from the defense.
All right, we'll take that under consideration. Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll recess.